I would like to state to begin with that I appreciate this opportunity of standing before you. I appreciate the congregation here for giving me this opportunity of both being your speaker and especially for asking me to speak upon this particular subject. The subject that Paul deals with in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 verses 2 through 16 concerns headship or authority between men and women. However, usually when we deal with this passage, we do so just as we will be doing today, not to study headship and authority, but we do so in order to figure out what the sign of authority is. In other words, we are generally looking for what constitutes the power that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 10 when he says, "For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels." Now, basically, the teaching found here is really in outline form. In verse 3, Paul simply states the fact concerning the ladder of authority. He says, "But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God." This ladder of authority places God as supreme, followed by Christ, then man, and finally woman. In verses 4 through 6, Paul teaches what men and women are to do in order to show others that they recognize and are indeed practicing God's teaching concerning the ladder of authority. In verses 7 through 10, he continues by explaining why man has authority over the woman. And then in verses 11 and 12, Paul somewhat parenthetically gives words of caution by stating that even though that man is over woman, as far as authority is concerned, that he does not have absolute control because, after all, Christ the Lord is over all, both man and woman. Finally, in verses 13 through 16, Paul concludes by comparing this authoritative position of men and women to the sign representing this authority and by noticing that even in the midst of contentious brethren, that the law of nature teaches that this covering is suitable both for as a sign of authority. Now, the purpose that I have taken time to give you this outline is simply that we may all understand that the teaching in this context is one thought, and really that is simply the subject of headship. The correct understanding of this passage depends upon us keeping the teachings in context. To me, I suppose one of the greatest reasons that people misunderstand God's Word is because at times we tend to take parts of God's Word here and apply it to another place where it really does not belong. Let us keep the thought in mind to keep the teachings in context. We will begin our study today in search of identifying this power or this covering by noticing what Paul says in verse 4. There he says, "Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head." Now in verse 3, Paul clearly stated that the head of every man is Christ. Christ, therefore, is man supreme, which man dishonors by having his head covered when praying or prophesying. Now within these words, I think it's very important that we understand that there is absolutely nothing in verse 4 to indicate that the terms praying or prophesying is restricted only to the worship services. Therefore, we must understand that the Apostle Paul is simply saying that man dishonors his head any time that he is praying or prophesying with his head covered. Obviously, if Paul had wanted to convince his readers that he was speaking of only in the worship services, I believe he had the capabilities of doing so. He could have said, even as he did further in the same chapter, in verse 18, he could have said, "When you come together in the church." He could have said, as he did in chapter 14, and in verse 34, where he said, "Your women are to keep silent in the church." In other words, he could have said, "Every man praying or prophesying in the church dishonoreth his head." But of course, we realize that he did not do that. However, regardless if these words has reference to the worship only, or really all times while praying or prophesying, we still must understand that a specific time is indeed referred to, and it is simply the time of praying or prophesying. In short, if man is praying or prophesying, he cannot be covered. To violate this would be an act of dishonoring Christ. However, if he is not praying or prophesying, he may be covered, simply because he is able to remove that covering before he starts into praying or prophesying again. And we're going to study this a little bit as we go on. Now, what does Paul mean by the words, having his head covered? The term having comes from a Greek word pronounced something like echo, according to Thayer is used in the sense of wearing. We find that Barry Orton Gendrit says, having his head covered indicates while he wears a covering on his head. Now the word head, as found here, is used in the sense of referring to man's physical head. Therefore, Paul has reference to man having his physical head covered with anything. Vinson says that these words literally means having anything hanging down or depending from the head. Or Bullinger's lexicon says having anything depending from the head. Therefore, in reference to man, we find that Paul is not speaking of a specific covering, but instead it seems that he is teaching that anything upon man's head is what man is not to have while praying or prophesying. This would be any type of an ornament. Now, since the word covered in this verse indicates anything on the head, I suppose it would include any type of ornament, regardless if it is man-made or God-given long hair, as Paul indicates in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and in verse 10. Now, concerning man's covering, which is anything on the head, Paul says that if he wears a covering while praying or prophesying, that he dishonoreth his head. Now, the term dishonoreth, according to such sources such as Strong's Dictionary, simply means to shame. In other words, if man wears anything on his head while praying or prophesying, he does something that brings forth shame. Likewise, we will find in verse 5 that if woman wears something or fails to wear something on her head while praying or prophesying, that she brings forth shame. The question today that we need to concern ourselves with, though, is what is this covering that brings forth shame? What is Paul really having reference to? Let us see chart number 1, please. Now, in this chart, which I simply called What Constitutes the Shame for Man, notice, if you will, first of all, in verse 4, that Paul says, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth or shames his head. Now, what is the covering that brings forth this shame? Now, I could stand up here and give you my answer, and you may give me your answer. But notice what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 14. He says, if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him. Now in verse 4, he's already said that something brings forth shame. Verse 14, he tells us what that shame is. Now let us see this second portion of that this same chart. What constitutes the shame for a woman? In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 5, Paul says, but every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered, dishonoreth or shames her head. Well, what is Paul having reference to? Alan, raise it up just a little bit. Notice, if you will, in verse 6, that Paul answers the same question by saying, if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shapen, let her be covered. See, we find that the Apostle Paul says that the way that she brings forth this shame is by being shorn or shaven. And then in verse 15, he goes a little further and says, but if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her. And the term glory is the opposite of shame. So therefore, we find that Paul really very clearly tells us what constitutes the shame. And that is in reference to long hair. Now, let us go a little further and consider the covering of woman. In verses 5 and 13, we find the term uncovered, coming from a Greek word similar to akonopoutos, which is defined by Thayer simply as not covered, unveiled. Now, Art and Gendrich on page 29 says that an uncovered woman is simply a woman without a head covering. Notice, first of all here, that the idea of anything on the head is not found here, as it was in verse 4 in reference to man. Therefore, a particular thing is under consideration and not simply anything. In other words, as Humphrey says, the Greek for uncovered and covered concerning woman is not the same as man at verse 4, which is literally having anything on his head. Now, since it is not the same word covered in verse 4, what is the covering that is found here that if not worn dishonors man? Well, I believe without a doubt that the context of 1 Corinthians 11 verses 2 through 16 will absolutely force us to accept the fact that Paul is talking about long, uncut hair. Adam, let's see chart number 2, please. In this particular chart, which I title, What Does the Context Teach? The purpose of this chart is to simply see what Paul is saying. Now, in these verses that I have on this chart, we will find every time Paul talking about woman being covered or uncovered. In verse 5, he says, every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered dishonoreth her head. Notice there, if you will, that the woman here is uncovered. Now, what is, then we find that Paul goes on further in the same verse by saying, for that is even all one as if you were shaven. Well, what is shaven? What is Paul having reference to? Well, certainly we see that he is talking about hair is being shaven. 1 Corinthians 11:6a. He says that the woman be not covered. Now there he says she is not covered. He goes on to say, let her also be shorn. Again I asked, what is shorn? Showing that Paul is having reference to hair again. 1 Corinthians 11:6b. If it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. Now there he tells her or gives the command to let her be covered. But he just referred to the idea of being shorn or shaven. What is shorn and what is shaven besides hair? 1 Corinthians 11:13-15, Paul would say, judging yourselves. Is it commonly that a woman praying to God uncovered? Then he goes further. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him, but if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given for a covering. I just wonder, what would it take to convince us, if we cannot be convinced by this context, that Paul is indeed talking about long hair? Again, we find today that many, many errors are made in trying to understand God's instructions as found here by not keeping the teachings in the proper context. If we keep these thoughts in context, how can Paul mean anything besides hair? Verse 15 clearly states that hair is given for a covering. This verse not only tells us what it is, but it goes further and strengthens and identifies it as long hair. Again, we want to go a little bit further. Let's notice in the last phrase of verse 5 that Paul tells us that the head uncovered is even all one or the same as or equal to the head being shaven. Now the Greek term translated if you are shaven is defined simply as to shear or to shave. Now when a woman is uncovered, that is when her hair is not left as nature would have it, and that is in an uncut state, she shames man by this act. And Paul simply shows that such an act is the same as having the hair shaved. Also, remember back in verse 3 that the subject under consideration here is headship. So what is woman doing if she cuts or shortens her hair in any way? Well, verse 5 is simply teaching that if a woman is without a covering, or when she is without a covering, that she dishonors her head. She dishonors man. Furthermore, we find that she ignores this headship. She dishonors man, and subsequently she disobeys God. A question that we are confronted with, though, at times, is why? Yes, why is the uncovered head the same as being shaved? The answer is simply that they both refer to hair that has been shortened. Therefore, either at means that they are without this covering. The Greek word, katakalupto, which is the word for covered in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 6, is actually a compound word. Now, this word is made up of kata and kalupto. The prefix kata primarily means down. However, according to a number of different studies, for example, one study that was made at the University of South Africa, they came up with the conclusion that when prefixed to a verb, its most usual meaning is completely. In his lexicon of New Testament words, W.J. Hickey simply says or defines this word as to mean to completely cover. Strong's in his dictionary says it means to cover wholly. Therefore, we should understand that God's desire for woman is that she honors man by wearing this sign of authority, that is, uncut hair. When the hair is shortened, even in the very least measure, the head is no longer completely covered. This is the reason that Paul tells them that if they're going to trim their hair, that if they're going to remove a small portion of their hair, they may as well go further and even remove it all. For example, if I were to cover my house with roofing, and then after it is completely done, if I were to go back and remove a small portion of that roofing, maybe in a place that you can't even tell that it's been removed, you may think that the house is completely roofed. However, I realize that in that first rainstorm, I would know that it was not completely covered, right? Well, it's the same way with woman. If she has what appears to be long hair, but yet she has removed part of that hair, then Paul is simply teaching her that she is uncovered because the covering is the complete hair. It's the hair as nature would have it. Further proof that the head uncovered refers to hair which has been shortened is in the fact that the Greek Old Testament, that is the Septuagint, the word uncovered, when it is having reference to the head being uncovered, this term always means hair that has been shortened. Let's see chart number 3. In this particular chart, which I simply titled, How is the Head Uncovered? I give two passages of scripture from Leviticus, from the book of Leviticus. In chapter 10 and verse 6, we find it says, And Moses said unto Aaron and to Eleazar and to Ithamar his son, Uncover not his head or your heads. Chapter 21 and verse 10, And he that is the high priest among his brethren shall not uncover his head, nor rend his clothes. First of all, notice the similarities between the English wording. Uncover not your head. We find that those same type of words in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Well, what does it mean to uncover not your head? I might add that these are the same words that you would find even in 1 Corinthians 11 from the Greek, or at least forms of these words. Well, what does it mean to uncover not your head? Jusenius in his Hebrew lexicon says, or defines it as to make naked, especially by shaving. How are they uncovered? By shaving. What is the conclusion? It is simply that the head is uncovered by doing something to the hair. Well, again, let's go a little bit further. We want to notice in verse 6 where Paul says, If the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. Notice with us, first of all, the condition of the woman referred to here in this verse. She no longer has her ornament. She is not covered. She is in an incomplete. She is not completely covered, as Hickey might tell us. She is not wholly covered, as Strong's would tell us. Her hair is no longer as nature would have it, due to having removed a small portion of it. Now understand, in this verse, we find that she has not removed enough hair to be called shorn. She has not removed it all to be called shaven, but she has merely trimmed her hair. But Paul shows the sinfulness of this act of trimming the hair by saying that in order to be consistent, let her also be shorn. Now this word also is defined by Thayer as likewise. And he says that this term marks something added to what has already been said, or that which something already said holds good. In this use, he says, it generally throws emphasis upon the word which immediately follows it. Now, what is the immediate following emphasized word that is referred to? It's the word shorn. Showing that indeed He is having reference to hair that is cut close, according to Benson. In other words, Paul is saying that if she is going to remove a small portion of her hair, for an example, if she is going to trim her hair, she may as well go further and be shorn, or even a step further than that, and be shaved. That is, remove all the hair. Vincent would tell us that the word shorn or shave simply means to have the hair cut close, or to be entirely shaved as with a razor. Now, as we continue, it is essential, I suppose, that we understand the reasons given by Paul as to why long hair is to be worn by woman and not by man. Many people today mistakenly believe that the long hair is no longer an issue because they claim it is simply a custom of the day. However, I think we need to realize what Paul has to say about this matter, because it was not a custom. Let us see chart number 6, please. In this particular chart, I simply call it why. That is, why man must not be covered. That is, why man must not have long hair, and why woman must have long hair. Notice that he gives in verses 7, 8, and 9 three different reasons, and really they're all linked together, as we're about to find out. But in verse 7, Paul says that man is the image and the glory of God. Now, that is the reason that Paul is given as to why man must not be covered. But then he goes further and say, but the woman is the glory of man. That's why she is to be covered. Nothing has reference to custom there. Again, number 2, we find that man is not of the woman. That's Paul's reason for why he must not be covered. But the woman is a woman is of the man. That is why a woman must be covered with this long hair. Verse 9, the man was not created for the woman. That's why man must not be covered. And Paul said, but the woman is the woman for the man in verse 9. And of course, that is simply the reason that Paul gives as to why she must be covered. Today, let us make sure that we understand Paul's teaching and that it has nothing to do with custom. Now, let us notice verse 10, where Paul says, for this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Now, we have just noticed in chart number 6, three reasons are given as to why a woman must be covered. However, here we find in verse number 10 that Paul says, for this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. In other words, it appears that Paul is linking all three of these reasons together and name only one reason. In other words, he has tied them together. He says, for this cause. Question. For what cause? Because of the order in which woman was created. Because she was created both of and for the man. And due to being created for the glory of man. Notice, if you will, that she is to have power on her head because of creation, not because of custom. Customs have changed repeatedly throughout the centuries, but creation has never changed. Verse 10 is often overlooked and omitted because of the many, many difficulties surrounding it. However, I feel that it is one of the most important verses throughout this context, and it must be thought through very carefully. We should understand it as much as we possibly can. Let us notice a few key words of verse 10. First of all, the term ought, as used here in reference to woman, just as it's found in verse 7 in reference to man, has reference or simply means must. In other words, Paul is saying that woman must have power on her head. She must do something. Well, what does that mean, that she must do that? Or what does the term ought actually mean? It is actually defined by Thayer as to be under obligation, bound by duty or necessity to do something. Notice, if you will, that the instruction given is not followed simply because the woman may desire to do so, which certainly she should, but it is not to be followed only for that reason. Again, it is not to be followed simply because it was a custom, but instead these instructions are to be followed out of a sense of necessity in obeying the inspired scriptures. Notice again, if you will, what is the instruction given for woman that she must do? Paul says that she must have power on her head. Thayer defines this word power as a sign of the husband's authority over his wife. Notice now that the woman's head cover in this verse is called power. Now the American Standard Version renders a sign of authority. Paul's instruction for the woman is that she must wear a sign as a sign of her subordination to man, as a sign that the woman has authority over her. Now the question that concerns us at time, though, is simply, what is this power? What is this sign? You know, the Apostle John records for us in the book of Revelation a very interesting fact. A fact, really, or a verse that I really was not familiar with until fairly recently. And that is in Revelation 9, verse 8. Notice carefully what John says. In Revelation 9 and verse 8, we find it says that they had the hair as the hair of woman. They had the hair as the hair of woman. This passage, first of all, indicates to us that the woman's hair is different from man's hair. Let us notice what Vine has to say concerning long hair, as well as in comparison to this, these words in Revelation 9 and verse 8. W.E. Vine says, the long hair of the spirit being, described as locusts in Revelation 9 and 8, is perhaps indicative of their subjection to their satanic masters. Compare 1 Corinthians 11 verse 10, revised version. Notice here that W.E. Vine is saying that long hair is indicative of their subjection, as mentioned in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 10 by the term power. Yes, Vine is plainly telling us that this power, this sign of subjection in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 10, has reference to the hair as the hair of woman. And what is that? Of course, we realize today that it is long hair, or the hair as the hair of woman in Revelation 9, verse 8. Now, concerning this word, power, Pharaoh refers to a statement of Callistratus, who twice uses this term to mean abundance of hair, resembling the aorist expression, a power of hair. Bloomfield quotes commentators who regards this Greek term for power as the name of a female ornament for the head formed with braids of hair set with jewels. You know, I also think that it's very interesting to realize that in the scriptures that long hair refers to power and cut hair refers to destruction. Vincent says, and I quote, the cutting off of the hair is used by Isaiah as a figure of the entire destruction of a people by divine retribution. Here we find that Vincent is simply having reference to Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 20, where it says, in the same day shall the Lord shave with a razor that is haired, namely by them beyond the river, by the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. You understand what he is saying? He is referring to these people as having their hair cut as a sign of destruction. And certainly we should look at it that way today. All of this we need to consider in the fact, we at times need to consider the fact that many scholars will look at this word power and they would translate it in different ways. For example, sometimes the word power is defined or is even translated in some very old manuscripts and translations as veil. Now, what does that mean? You know, we find that it is, number one, it's very important for us to understand that at times the words hair and veil are used interchangeably. And therefore, we must make a distinction between the two, for it is sometimes very difficult to do so. For an example, the Hebrew word tisma, and I know I mispronounced that, but it's going to have to do. But this particular word, which is also translated into the Greek katakaluma, which is a noun form of the verb katakalupto, is found in verse 6 referring to the covering. We find that this word is translated both hair and veil. And this is something that many people that I, for many, many years, misunderstood. Examples can be found. For example, look at Isaiah 47 and verse 2. And here we can find that the King James Version translates, uncover thy locks. Or as we would say today, uncover thy hair. The American Standard Version says, remove thy veil. Now, what does it mean to uncover thy locks or to remove thy veil? Jesenius on page 170 defines this as to make naked, to uncover by taking away the hair. In other words, he is saying that the translation to remove thy veil means to uncover by taking away the hair. The same word is also used in other passages where the King James Version would translate locks and others would translate the word veil. Let us see chart number 7, please. In this chart that I call hair and veil, used interchangeably, I noticed three different passages of Scripture, all coming from the Song of Solomon. In chapter 4 and verse 1, the King James Version says, thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. The American Standard Version says, thine eyes are as doves behind thy veil. The footnote says, veil or locks, to show that it can be translated either way. Chapter 4, verse 3, thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. The American Standard Version says, thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate behind thy veil. The footnote again says, veil or locks. Chapter 6 and verse 7, the King James Version says, as a piece of pomegranate are thy temples within thy locks. The American Standard Version again says, thy temple are like a piece of pomegranate behind thy veil. What is the conclusion? The conclusion from this is that the terms hair and veil are used interchangeably by the translators. Does this mean that either one has mistranslated the word? No, it simply appears that they both at times are translated hair and or at other times translated veil. Well, as we can see in this chart, every time the King James Version translates locks, the American Standard Version translates veil. The term translated locks, as we have just noticed, is defined by Jesenius on page 712. Notice, locks is defined as a woman's veil. Young's Analytical Concordance says that this term, which is also a form of the one in verse 6 of 1 Corinthians 11, that it is a lock of hair or veil in these same passages. Now, let us notice verses 11 and verse 12. The words found here, it seems, are said in order to correct any misunderstanding of Paul's words. Man is indeed the head of woman in an authoritative position. However, this does not give man the right to despise, neglect, nor to treat the woman as some form of a slave. While man is superior as far as the line of headship is concerned, he is not her master in the sense of a slave, because we find that she is equal in many ways. The Apostle Paul taught of this in Galatians 3, verse 28. As he would say, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. Here we see that man is cautioned to understand that he is incomplete without the woman, just as much as a woman is incomplete without the man. Let's go a little further. Our time is quickly running out, and there's a lot of material I'd like to cover. Let us also notice the question posed by Paul in verse 13. In verse 13, Paul says, judge in yourselves. Is it comely that a woman praying to God uncovered? Paul has already given his reasons based upon creation as to why a woman should wear a sign of authority or wear this sign of subjection. Now he tells the Corinthians to judge or to consider for themselves concerning the appropriateness of woman being uncovered. In other words, he is simply telling them to look at this and decide and to give their own opinion as to whether it is proper for them to do so. The word comely, as used here, has nothing to do with the idea of custom. He is not asking for their opinions of their custom. But instead, Paul is asking them to consider, to decide within themselves, is it becoming, seemly? Is it fit for a woman to be uncovered? It seems that he felt that their honesty will cause them to realize that by being uncovered, by removing or cutting their hair short, would simply be putting them on the same level of authority as man. Now we'll see chart number 8, please. In this chart, I mentioned a moment ago that we want to notice Paul's questions and answer. Now, in verse 13, Paul asks that question, judging yourselves. Notice the question. Is it comely that a woman praying to God uncovered? Now, it seems that Paul, even without giving them an opportunity of answering that question, he answers it for them. Is it comely that a woman pray uncovered? Verses 14 and 15, Paul answers by saying, doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame to him, but if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given for a covering. The conclusion found here is that contextually, Paul is defining the covering mentioned in verse 13 as long hair. And people, I think it should be able to be clearly understood in this sense. In verses 14 and 15, Paul plainly declares that man was intended to be uncovered and woman covered. As indicated here, woman is covered by having long hair, and man is uncovered by cutting his hair. Now, Dean Alford many times is somewhat misquoted. And I want to quote word for word what Dean Alford has to say concerning being veiled. Here he said, Dean Alford says, and I quote, the mere fact of one sex being by nature unveiled, that is, having short hair, the other veiled, that is, having long hair. Understand, this that is clause does not come from me. It comes from Dean Alford. Notice again. He says that being unveiled, that is having short hair, the other veiled, that is having long hair. Well, the question that is asked from time to time, though, and quite often, is how long is long? The answer to this question is very, very important today. Because man must not have this covering of long hair, or else he dishonors Christ. On the other hand, woman must have this covering, or else the scriptures refers to her as dishonoring her head, which is man. How long is long? The answer is simply hair that has not been shortened. The term long hair is translated from a Greek term which there defines as to let the hair grow. When men and women do anything to their hair, when they cut it, trim it, break it, burn it, listen, when they give perms knowing that it's going to break their hair is not long.
Amen.
They have short hair. They are uncovered. And brothers and sisters, we need to make sure that we understand these words. Sometimes women will say, well, when I trim the dead ends off my hair will grow longer. You know, the answer to the response to that can be in a number of different ways, because really the truth to that statement is very immaterial. It does not matter if the hair will grow longer once it is shortened or once it is trimmed. The proper question to be asked is, when the hair is trimmed, has it been shortened? And obviously the answer is yes. And if the answer is yes, that just simply means the woman is no longer covered. We need to make sure we understand that. Again, I ask the question, how long is long hair? Chart number 9. How long is long hair? Notice Ezekiel 44, verse 20. I think it's a very interesting passage. It says, neither shall they shave their heads, nor suffer their locks to grow long. They shall only poll their heads. Now here I find three different lengths of hair. Number one, it is referred to as shaved hair. Number two is polled hair. Number three is hair that is called long hair. Now, I think we're familiar with the idea of shaved and long, but what does the word poll mean? I guess the easiest way to notice that or to find out
is to go to a couple of translations. The Revised Standard Version, instead of saying pull their heads, says trim the hair of their heads. Goodspeed will say to clip the hair. If you look in an English or a Greek or Hebrew lexicon, you'll find that the word pull means to trim or to clip. Therefore, the conclusion is that long hair is not shaved hair, and long hair is not trimmed hair. There is no way that a woman can trim her hair, I don't care how short or how long that she leaves it, there is no possible way that she can trim her hair and still have be covered with long hair. Even by a verse simply as this, to show that long hair is not trimmed hair. Let us now notice the last phrase of verse 15. Here we find that Paul says, for her hair is given for a covering. The hair as used here has reference to ornamental hair. The hair as an ornament is given for, instead of, or answering to a covering. Now we have a problem in the minds of some, and that is because the word covering here is coming from a Greek noun, parabolaion. Vine tells us that the term hair has reference to a sign of subjection in verses 1 through 10. Let me quote to you the words of Vine. Notice very carefully. He says, the word hair is found in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 15, where the context, and it's the context I keep telling you about, where the context shows that the covering provided in the long hair of woman is as a veil, a sign of subjection to authority, as indicated in the headship spoken of in verses 1 through 10. Now notice there that Vine is speaking of verses 1 through verse 10, and he says that it is the hair that stands for that subjection. Objections, though, are sometimes made to this idea that the covering referred to in verse 15 is speaking of the same covering referred to in verses 5, 6, and 13, and the objections go something like this. It is based upon the fact that different Greek words are used, that a form of katakalupto is found in verses 5, 6, 7, and 13, but in verse 15 is the Greek noun parabolaion, and the argument goes that the verbs and nouns cannot be correctly used with one another. Well, understand, from my study at least, I found that this is only a theory and not a fact. Chart number 11, please. In this chart that I simply call Greek Scholars on Verbs and Nouns, I have quoted from two different scholars. First, Leon Crouch, concerning these two different words, says they are certainly never used together in the New Testament. Notice, however, a study of the use of those words in those sources indicate that they could possibly be used together. Yes, they can be used together. Again, let us notice in Meyer on page 256. He says, parabolaion, something thrown round one, a covering in general, has here a special reference to the veil, kaluptra or kaluma, spoken of in the context. Let's see chart number 12, please. Now, sometimes people will say, well, that's just their opinions. Let's find the opinions of the scriptures. Genesis 38, 14, and 15. Now, in one context, in one idea, where it's talking about one time, notice it says in verse 14 that Tamar covered her with the veil. And the word covered there comes from a form of the word parabolaion, as you can see. But verse 15 says that Judah thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. And there he doesn't use the form of parabolaion. He uses the term katakalupto, which again is referring to the word covered as found in verse 6. Psalms 104, verse 6, and then verse 9, speaking of the same incident. Notice, thou coverest with the deep as with a garment. The word coverage there is the Greek term parabolaion, as you would find in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 15. But verse 9 says, thou hast set a bound that they may not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. And there he doesn't use a form of parabolaion. He uses the term coming from katakalupto or kalupto. So therefore we can find that even in the Greek Old Testament, in the Septuagint, that they are found used together. And if nothing else can convince us, then certainly that should. Many people today, and I know my time is about gone, I got about 2 or 3 minutes, I'll be through if I can have that long. Many people attempt to erase everything that Paul has had to say in verses 2 through 15 by quoting verse 16, which says, "But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, and neither the churches of God." However, such efforts as this is simply vain, because as we've already noticed, Paul is not talking about custom. Furthermore, he is certainly not telling these people that if you don't agree with me, you don't have to obey my words. Because later, even in this same chapter, he would say, "I have received of the Lord that which also I delivered unto you." Well, what does Paul mean by the words "have" or "we have no such custom"? First of all, the pronoun "we," according to Bloomfield, refers to Paul and the other apostles. The term "such" is defined by Thayer as "such as this" or "of this sort." In other words, Paul is saying that none of the apostles share in this sort of custom that the Corinthians were practicing. Now, concerning this idea of the word custom found in verse 16, I find that there's really three different views. The first view, some people say that Paul was referring to women being not covered when praying or prophesying. The problem with that view is that the pronoun "we" in verse 16 does not refer to women. It refers to the apostles. Number two, some people say that Paul has reference to the custom of being contentious. In other words, none of the apostles maintain a contentious spirit.